right. Hello, everyone, and welcome back into the Salt City Hoops podcast. This is our second edition in the ESPN 700 studio, so I'm glad to join you from beautiful Salt Lake City, Utah, once again. My name is Andy Larson. I'm the managing editor of saltcityhoops.com. We're the ESPN True Hoop affiliate of the Utah Jazz. And again, here along with Ben Dowsett, writer and co-host of this program. So, Ben, how are you doing after that exciting game one?
First of all, don't forget extraordinaire.
Extraordinaire.
But second of all, I'm the slightest bit traumatized as a LeBron homer personally, but as an overall basketball fan, it was still an excellent game, so I'm still I'm all right.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think LeBron is your favorite athlete of all time.
He is. He he definitely is. So there were parts of that weren't so good, but there are six games left, and at the same time, I'm also an objective basketball analyst, and there was an excellent game of basketball played despite certain auxiliary conditions.
Yeah, but so I want to know. I want to give you the post game interview here, Ben. What was going on through your head when LeBron went down like that?
I don't know if I don't know if the wholesome folks want to hear that. Obviously, I wasn't thrilled. You know, you don't like to see situations like that. As I'm sure the players on both teams, you don't want to see something like that happen. It's very hard. You know, you want in the moment, especially when you have a rooting interest, like I guess to a point I do. I do root for the Jazz, but when they're eliminated, I guess I kind of go for LeBron. You know, you want to blame somebody or something or whatever, and in certain situations, you really just can't do that. It's an electrical surge. There's really nothing you can do.
There's no conspiracy.
No, I'm personally not much for conspiracy theories ever in terms of anything. That's just me. But you know, it does suck. And one thing that I do think that's unfortunate is I do think that the type of player LeBron is and the way he moves, the amount of mass he has and things like that, and I'm no doctor, and we may get into this later when Dan Clayton comes on, but I do think there's a very good chance that type of thing affects LeBron more than your average basketball player, and I did find that much unfortunate.
Yeah, I'm excited for our conversation with Dan today. So just a quick show. I'm excited for the show overall. We've got Dean DeMacis of DeanOnDraft.com. He's a professional gambler about the NBA, and so we're going to have him on talking about the NCAA prospects, look at his analysis of them, have him on in about 5 minutes, and then we'll have Dan Clayton join us in about 25 minutes throughout the podcast. And continue our argument from Twitter online last night, as well as talk to him. He attended the draft lottery in New York City a couple of weeks ago, talked to him about that experience, and then kind of get his thoughts on the overall draft as well. So continuing our conversation, so you're going to write this piece, or I guess you have already written this piece about the NBA Finals. We're going to be publishing on Salt City Hoops later today. Besides the LeBron injury, what was the biggest determining factor in Game 1?
Well, early on, it looked to be turnovers. It looked as though the Heat might be continuing some of their success defensively from last year. Well, not that they were the greatest in last year's finals, but I guess suppose they got the job done. There were 18 turnovers through the first three quarters for the Spurs. Miami's swarming defense was really doing some things. And who knows after that whether the Heat had anything to do with it. It certainly didn't for San Antonio, you suppose. But that fourth quarter, obviously, San Antonio turned things around quite a bit. I think they shot like 88% or something like that for the quarter, which is – so the fourth quarter is obviously a big key. I don't know that you point to necessarily one thing. Manu Ginobili was excellent. I wrote a couple days ago on Hickory High, or yesterday on Hickory High, about him and how he needed to improve from last year. He had a pretty dismal finals last year, and he was, if he does this every game, the Spurs are going to be in very, very good shape. 11 assists for the game in just 33 minutes. He was very impressive.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so what I think is interesting is, so first of all, the LeBron injury, and I know we're going back to this, I'm sorry, but I just think that's one of the only instances that you'll ever see a basketball game so determined by, like, one set of factors causing one thing to happen that completely changed the game, right? Miami's up 2 when LeBron exits, down 15 when the game ends. I mean, LeBron isn't that impactful of a player, right? He's not a plus 180 over 48 minutes, but you know, I just think that's one of the only instances that you'll ever see that happen. And then point two on that, I think part of it, the Spurs' advantage over the Heat is just kind of the number of international players that the Spurs have. So through the first half last night, for example, all of the Spurs' points, all 54 points came from players born outside of the United States.
Yeah, I saw that stat, yeah.
And For the Miami Heat, all 49 of their points came from players born within the 50 United States. So, you know, the Spurs are guys who are used to playing in these European arenas that are hot and humid and musty and, you know, fans throwing batteries at you and whatever else happens over there.
Batteries.
Yeah. No, it's frightening. And then, you know, they come over to the NBA and to some extent, it, you know, it's better. But when it reverts to that sort of situation, and I'm not saying the Spurs fans were throwing batteries, but, you know, it's a difficult climate.
You never know. No, I'm just joking.
Then
Spurs fans are great.
You know, yeah, then they can deal with it better than the Heat could. And especially LeBron James. You know, Chris Bosh noted after the game that he was born in Dallas. He's kind of used to playing at this conditions. He's used to playing at this level of heat. LeBron grew up in Ohio. It's just not that hot there during at least playing basketball season. You know, I'm sure St. Vincent St. Mary's gym has air conditioning, and either way, he's playing there from November to March anyway, right?
Yeah.
Like, when was there ever a competitive basketball game in which LeBron was playing at that temperature before?
I mean, if there was, it was a very long time ago, you have to assume. And Dan did make the point on Twitter, and he's probably right. There were probably some instances in some summer, you know, in practices or in some, you know, non-NBA related things. Players play a lot of basketball and things like that, you know, potentially during the offseason. We can't say for sure whether he's never experienced those conditions recently or anything right. like that. But, of course, they're very, very far from the norm. He's played hundreds and hundreds of games in other circumstances and is, you know, is very used to those circumstances. And, again, as I was saying, I do think there's a chance that he just taxes his body a lot more heavily than most people do. He's carrying the team, right? Well, and he's just the raw mass that the guy's That's carrying it. And how quick he carries it and how frequently he does so. I think there's a decent – I mean, I think if you broke it down by – I don't – again, totally no doctor, but if you broke it down in the, you know, calories burned per minute on the court or something like that, he would have to be near the top of the NBA, if not at the very top.
Yeah, I want to track that stat. That's got to be in Sport View or something.
We got to get that eventually, yeah.
So I want to, before Dean jumps on the show in a couple minutes here, I just want to talk with you. So we talked a lot about Noah Vonleh last week, especially on how much, whether or not he's the right fit for the Jazz at number five. And you and I have both been doing some research on Marcus Smart recently. And to me, Marcus Smart might be the guy that I take at number five, regardless of whether or not you have Trey Burke there. You know, the Jazz have good players at all five positions. That's, at least somewhat good. That's part of the problem. But you and I both looked at Marcus Smart, and I wanted to know, I think we kind of disagree on him a little bit, right? Like, I like him a lot, and you've got some serious question marks.
Yeah, I will say that I've been doing my heaviest research in the last couple days, and I will admit that when I initially made that statement, I had not looked enough at his defense yet, and that is something that I obviously like about him. It's hard not to, if you've watched him. I do have some serious concerns that I'm wondering how they're going to transfer over, and when you watch... The phrase decision-making tends to occasionally be overused, and in his case, it gets lumped in with some type of mental acuity. The whole Texas Tech incident or that was Texas Tech, right?
I think so, yeah.
Pushing the fan, the whole thing with that, and I don't necessarily buy into that whole thing. When I talk decision-making with a player like this, I mean his on-court decision-making, I mean his shot selection, the way he tries to control the game. You know, this is a guy who's, at least in college, was playing point guard. Whether the Jazz would be drafting him to do that or maybe be a complementary player with Trey Burke, it's, I suppose, a little bit hard to say. But you have to assume he's going to be handling the ball at least a reasonable amount. And that is the main area of concern that I have for him, is you see him make a lot of bad decisions on the court. And I know these things can certainly, just like everything, you can improve over time as you get into the NBA and have better coaching, more discipline, and things like that. I worry that Smart might be one of those guys. I just see certain early signs that tend to raise red flags for me that he might be one of those guys that's never gonna, you know, just those guys that you talk about that never fully get it. I think almost like a Tyreek Evans sometimes when I look at him, because he's clearly got the ability everywhere. And there are almost times where it feels like he's attempting to prove that on the court in ways that are detrimental to the team.
Interesting. See, I'm curious about this because I totally agree. I think his defense is his strongest point. But I like at least that ability. I think he can develop on that. I think he can use his offensive ability and then develop kind of the NBA decision-making later. And I think it's maybe even easier in the NBA. I think that this is a weird point, but I think it's a little bit easier in the NBA to find that open guy. Sometimes it's so ritualistic that you can find the open guy off a corner three that that may not happen in college as much. I don't know what I'm actually saying here.
I think I kind of do. Like maybe your teammates know the system a little bit better. Like he's playing in college with a bunch of guys who there's a good chance.
Right, it's Oklahoma State.
Exactly,
not
yeah.
Kansas.
Yeah.
Anyway, we actually have got Dean on the phone, and I'd like to bring him into this conversation. Dean, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great, thanks. So again, Dean, before we kind of have you jump in, can you give us just like the 1 minute bio about yourself? I love your work on Dean on Draft. Just tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got into it, et cetera.
Sure. So basically, I earn my income betting on basketball. You know, nothing like compared to like Geraldo Vulgaris or anything. Just kind of, you know, I do more so, you know, just prop betting and NCAA basketball betting, you know, sort of the more beatable markets instead of, you know, mastering the NBA. But I am a big NBA fan. I'm a big NCAA fan. And what I kind of noticed is that, you know, you have all these sites like, you know, ESPN has Chad Ford who, you know, collects the information from all these different front offices, scouts, and he kind of presents the mean average. And then Draft Express has the really good scouting reports. But nobody really takes kind of like a gambler's approach. This says, you know, from like a probabilistic perspective, this is who the best prospect should be. So I kind of felt like I could fill that, you know, market niche where I say, you know, not this is what GMs think, this is what scouts think, but this is what I think, you know, will be the best NBA players. So, you know, I started my own blog, DeanOnDraft.com, and, you know, now I'm, you know, making my own predictions and, you know, this is my first year doing it, and, you know, I'm really excited for the draft, and we're going to see how it goes.
Cool. Yeah, and I mean, if you haven't checked it out, listeners, go to DeanOnDraft.com because his opinions are really, they're really smart, right? I mean, you back up everything that you write. It's not just your opinion after watching the scouting. It's, you know, I've watched this guy, and then I've got the numbers to back it up. So kind of bringing you into this Marcus Smart conversation, I'm curious what you think about him as a prospect. I know you wrote about his defense recently. Kind of give us your overall impressions and whether or not he's going to be a successful player or really even can he be an all-star in the NBA?
Well, I'm really high on Marcus Smart personally, and I think it definitely starts with his defense. You can't really, you know, bring him up and not address that first. And I'm really high in his defense. I think, you know, he's arguably the best perimeter defensive prospect in the draft because even though he's just, you know, a 6'3 point guard, he made an insane impact on Oklahoma State's defense in his 2 years there. You know, Chad Ford's not a good coach. He doesn't historically have good defenses. They didn't have, you know, great rim protection. And this year, for the second half of the season, they barely had any rim protection at all. They were really undersized. Yet, you know, Marcus Smart just, you know, he just plays really great on defense. He racks up a ton of steals. In spite of all his steals, you know, he still, you know, doesn't really give up too many easy buckets from his matchup. And he kind of just seems, you know, on all levels, just, you know, the guy who just makes a huge impact on defense. So I feel like that gives him a really strong baseline value as a prospect. And, you know, I heard you guys comparing him to Terry Devin, which I think is actually a pretty good comparison, but I don't really view it as a negative that much because, you know, Tyreke Evans is a rookie. He looked like he was on the path to stardom.
Yeah, that's true.
And I don't know what exactly happened, whether, you know, he just wasn't putting in the work or whether, you know, the Kings did something wrong in his developmental stages. I have no idea what happened, but, you know, he got off to a really great start. So if you say maybe, you know, a Tyreke Evans who's, you know, maybe not as good on offense but a little better on defense, but if you say, well, what if he took the developmental path where instead of kind of regressing from his rookie year, he got better and better and better, that's an all-star player.
That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, you start with the 25-5 Tyreke Evans and then hopefully improve. You know, maybe he's worse at offense than that, but, you know, building from that rather than regressing from that would be huge.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I'm high on Marcus Smart. You know, I get the criticism he's kind of a jack-of-all-trades, a master of none on offense, but, you know, he seems like the type of personality who, you know, you just wouldn't really want to bet against to kind of, you know, exceed expectations in a really significant manner. You know, steal rate is something that's historically really predictive, not only of defense, but also of offense.
More of offense, yeah.
Yeah, and he kind of has that big steal rate. So, you know, is that going to forecast, you know, outliery offensive development? You know, maybe, I don't know. And if not, you still get, you know, a really good defensive player, probably, who can also, you know, at least hold his own on offense, you know, handle, pass, finish. You know, he can shoot threes at least at break even. So, yeah, I'm really high on Marcus Smart, and, you know, I think he has high floor, high ceiling.
Do you not worry so much about the shooting stroke? The way he turns sideways on the follow through on his shooting stroke. I mean, that's his form is honestly at the moment. And I know this is something that can drastically change over the course of an NBA player's career, and frequently does. But does that concern you at all? And then the one other thing that I'll mention in terms just stylistically is does ball handling, maybe on a very high NBA point guard level, concern you just a little bit, the quickness of his ball handling and his ability to shake individual defenders?
Yeah, I think those are both valid concerns, and those are kind of the reasons why he's not in the conversation for a top three pick. I think he should be in the conversation anyway, but those are the reasons why he's not. And those are kind of his limitations on offense. But what I would kind of say, why the shooting thing doesn't really bug me that much is because, you know, 30% isn't a great three-point percentage, but he shot a really high volume, and he shot an inordinately high percentage of his shots off the dribble.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you have him maybe, throw away some of the off-the-dribble shots and replace those with, you know, spot-up opportunities, maybe his shot isn't quite as bad. And also, you know, shooting is something that can improve a lot over the course of his career, so he's not completely hopeless. And even if he does become, you know, a 30% three-point shooter, I think, you know, that's enough to fit him into an NBA lineup, given the fact that, you know, he can do other things. And I would also agree that his ball handling can use tightening up, but I don't think it's really, you know, necessarily a weakness. It's just, you know, not a big strength for him right now. But, you know, he seems like the type of guy who has the work ethic where he can, you know, put in the work and, you know, tighten it up to the point where it is good enough for him to kind of be, you know, maybe the number one or maybe a number two scoring option on a pretty good team. So, you know, that's something that, you know, if it doesn't develop as well as you want, well, you know, maybe he's just more of, you know, a defensive role player, maybe something like a slightly more offensive, versatile Tony Allen, who's not quite as good on defense. But, you know, nobody really is, you know, you can't get a surefire all-star if you don't have a number one pick. You know, everybody's going to have some sort of risk. So that's why it doesn't really bother me that much, because, you know, they both can be overcome, and they're not glaring words. You know, it's not like his shot isn't as bad as Aaron Gordon. It's just not great.
Right. So on kind of the other side of the spectrum, one guy who you actually like a lot less than Marcus Smart is Andrew Wiggins. And I want to get your explanation to the audience of, A, why you think Wiggins is overrated as a prospect, and kind of what you think his NBA future is like.
Okay, well, first of all, you know, the reason why Wiggins is rated highly is, you know, he has these amazing tools. You know, he's explosive, he can jump through the roof, he's fast, he's quick, he has, you know, good height and length for a wing. You know, he's really skinny, but, you know, in theory, he could add weight. And then all of his weaknesses are skill-related, so they're all improvable. So you figure, you know, he has sort of, you know, the T-Mac or Paul George, you know, physical tools. They're probably even better. You know, he has really unique athleticism. And you figure everything else is improvable, so the sky's the limit, draft really high, you know, and just hope for the best. But kind of the overlooked narrative, in my opinion, is just that his offensive skill level is really not that good right now. And yes, it's improvable, but he can improve it quite a bit and still have it not be good enough to be an all-star level. You know, he's going to have to improve at an outlier rate to become, you know, that Paul George-level superstar. And I think that's, you know, really the underplayed angle. You know, statistical models don't love him that much because, you know, even though he scored 17 points a game, most of it was in transition or at the free throw line, and neither of those translate to the NBA quite as well as, you know, half-court scoring. And, you know, his handle's kind of limited. He doesn't have great vision or feel for the game. His assisted turnover rate is kind of mediocre. You know, he's a good shooter, but, you know, 34% threes is that, you know, you can't really, you know, just make him an offensive superstar strictly based on his shot. You know, he's not a great shooter. And also, he really struggled to finish at the rim, and he was kind of oddly uncoordinated and, you know, just bricked a lot of layups. So even if you say those are all improvable, well, will he improve them enough? And I kind of feel like, you know, he has a wide range of outcomes in the pros because you don't know, you know, is he going to develop poorly and kind of be, you know, maybe he's just not going to develop well at all and kind of just be, you know, a Marvin Williams kind of, you know, fringe starter, you know, bench player. Or maybe he could follow the Rudy Gay career arc and kind of be the guy who, you know, he can get buckets, but at the same time, you know, he just kind of doesn't really have the vision. It doesn't make the defensive contributions to kind of make a positive impact on his team. Or then the more optimistic scenario, in my opinion, is sort of you say, all right, well, he'll develop it well enough to be a pretty good offensive player and be good on defense to kind of give you that 3-and-D role player like Luol Deng or Thaddeus Young, who's, you know, they're not superstars, but, you know, they're really solid cogs to put in the team. And then on paper, he has that. He, in theory, could become, you know, Paul George level, you know, top five superstar. And that's really what you need to assign a high, you know, or not a high probability, but at least, you know, a realistic slice of probability to justify taking him to the top three. And that's kind of, you know, I think the big question for, you know, where does Andrew Wiggins go is, you know, how likely is he to become a Paul George level superstar?
Yeah, and I think the you kind of touched on it. The issue is that it's almost just such a blank palette right now in terms of his actual skill development. And while, you know, certainly one portion of the possibility there is that he completely fills that palette to, you know, hits his ceiling in nearly every area and, yeah, and becomes a Paul George-type superstar, but the odds of all those things, all the different things that you mentioned, all of which are true, all of those improving over the course of his career, that's not very easy to do. There's not too many examples of guys that have been able to fill that many categories and coming in with so little actual fundamental skill, especially offensively.
Yeah, exactly. And sort of the other angle that nobody really ever talks about that kind of fascinates me that I would like to explore is that he was supposed to be the best player in college basketball this year. You know, he had insane levels of hype. And, you know, he had a good season. You know, he was a unanimous vote to all Big 12 first team. You know, he scored 17 points a game. He was the team's best perimeter defender. It was, you know, they finished as, you know, a top 15 team, I think, according to KenPom. Maybe it was 12 or something. But at the same time, you know, he still arguably, you know, he was expected to be the number one player in college, and he arguably was not even the top 50 player in college. So it's sort of, and if you read all the old scouting reports, everybody says, oh, you know, just wait for his frame to fill out for him to develop his skills, and he's going to be great. But then, you know, he shows up, he didn't add as much weight as people had hoped, his skills weren't that developed. So you have to sort of stop and pause and say, well, you know, he developed not only not well, but exceptionally poorly from high school to college. And, you know, people mature, you know, maybe he'll pick up his work ethic going forward, but for a guy who developed that poorly from high school to college, are we going to really, you know, from ages 16 to 19, are we really going to, you know, feel comfortable projecting a really outliery growth rate from 19 to 27? Because he can accelerate it quite a bit and still only have, you know, an average growth rate and then kind of just still be on the path to solid role player as opposed to superstar.
Yeah, and that's kind of the scary thing to me is just, yeah, the probabilities that you point out. You know, if he hasn't improved to this point, what's the likelihood that he takes that leap at age 19, at age 20, given the kind of questionable skill development that's happened from 16 to 19? I want to move on, though, before we were actually over how long I said I would have you on. Hopefully that's all right. Ben, you've got a question?
Oh, no, I was...
Oh, sorry, you were pointing at... I want to ask you if, first of all, if you were the Jazz at number 5, would you take Marcus Smart?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
You know, the way I see the Jazz is the Jazz have a lot of solid pieces. You know, like Trey Burke. I like Trey Burke. I like Gordon Hayward. You know, Fitz Favors isn't bad. You know, Burke's showing some signs of life. But you don't really have sort of, you know, the centerpiece who, you know, the superstar who you can kind of build your team around and say, you know, this guy is going to be the guy who's going to ensure that we're going to be hunting in the playoff race every year. So until you kind of get that guy, I think you have to keep on drafting. You have to draft for the guy who's most likely to become that player. So I would definitely take Marcus Smart at number 5. I think he can coexist with Trey Burke. You know, they both kind of need the ball on offense, but, you know, Marcus Smart provides so much value on defense that, you know, maybe you can find a,
you know, find a way to make the two-point guard system work and kind of get Marcus Smart's defensive impact on the floor since he's big enough to guard shooting guards. And they kind of run a three-guard rotation with, you know, Burks and Smart. And then, you know, if it doesn't fit that well, you know, maybe explore trading the, you know, whoever didn't develop quite as well as the other ones. But, you know, I would definitely, you know, I would definitely take him because simply because he might be the guy who becomes the best player on your team, who becomes, you know, the centerpiece of your franchise.
A question for you, Dean. The guy I'm going to mention isn't somebody who would be in consideration for the Jazz at number five. And in fact, it's unlikely they'd be able to get him based on where he's projected to go currently. But tell me in a few words, we've talked a lot about Smart already, but tell me in a few words, why I look at Elfrid Payton and then I look at Marcus Smart. I know Smart's more dynamic athletically, especially on offense, and can probably do a lot more from a dynamic sense there. But from a developmental standpoint, tell me what about Marcus Smart makes him significantly better than someone like an Elfrid Payton, who has the same sort of defensive prowess. I mean, he was guarding Doug McDermott in the NCAA tournament this year. He has the same sort of issues with his jumper that Smart does, but he's also a very good attacker of the rim, very good distributor, very good ball handler.
I love how much Elfrid Payton is your guy. You're just going to bat for Payton.
Yeah, well, a lot of people like him. He's come up quite a bit.
Yeah, well, I'm an Elfrid Payton fan, but I think you can kind of get in the trap of saying, oh, you know, he has the same strength defensively and the same weaknesses with respect to shooting. Elfrid Payton's a worse shooter than Marcus Smart.
Yeah.
You know, Marcus Smart made 30% of threes and 75% of free throws, and Elfrid Payton made 27% of threes and 61% of free throws. So Elfrid Payton, and also Marcus Smart shot a much higher volume of three-pointers, which is also sort of predictive as well. So Elfrid Payton's the guy you have to worry. You know, can this guy even shoot above break even? Can he even hit 30% of his threes in the NBA? And if not, that makes it, you know, a lot harder to fit him off the ball. And similarly, defensively, you know, Elfrid Payton's a really good defensive player. He hawks the ball. He moves his feet pretty well. I think he can be a good defensive point guard. But, you know, did he have any sort of – he doesn't have Marcus Smart's theory, and, you know, he doesn't really have any – team like Louisiana Lafayette, I know, you know, he wasn't surrounded with the most talent. Or actually, he did have Sean Long, who I think, you know, deserves to get drafted whenever he leaves. But other than those two, they were pretty much the entire team. But still, he didn't really have that sort of outliery defensive impact from the team to point to that Marcus Smart did. So he doesn't have. So even though defense is a positive, it's not quite as much of a glowing positive as Smart. And shooting is a bit bigger of a weakness, but. At the same time, Elfrid Payton still could become the better player than Marcus Smart because, you know, one area of advantage that stands out for me for Payton is he has a much better handle than Smart, at least from what I've seen. He seems to have I've been impressed with Elfrid Payton's handle and, you know, the few games I've watched of him. So, you know, I like Payton a lot. I just, you know, like Smart more.
Cool. No, I got so many different questions for you, Dean, but unfortunately we've got another caller who's going to be calling in 1 minute, so we're going to have to let you go. We'll have you on again before the draft, though. Thanks again so much for joining us.
Okay, yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Dean, I just love his website, and like that was smart NBA draft analysis.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, that guy clearly knows what he's doing. He makes his living based off covering NBA and NCAA basketball. He's, you know, actually going out there predicting who's successful and who's not. And, you know, I think there's a lot of stock in believing what he says, especially I like what he says about Marcus Smart. Maybe that's just because that's who will be available at number five.
True.
But I'm hopeful that he can be the kind of player that Dean says he can be.
Yeah, I'm really coming around in terms of Smart. Not complete, and I can't say for sure that he's the guy that I would draft if I were the Jazz, but I'm a lot closer to saying that than I even was potentially a week ago, where we were talking about Noah Vonleh. And I still do think in a vacuum, I think Vonleh is probably the better prospect, although I'm getting closer. But yeah, it should be. And then one thing that it comes to, and I don't know how much time we have and whether we maybe be able to discuss this, but just in a second or two before we have Dan on here, what necessarily makes if we're looking optimistically at Smart and the certain weaknesses that he does have, and assuming that he's going to be able to work past a lot of those in the NBA, what necessarily makes Dante Exum a significantly better prospect than him? Because
I mean, I think you look at like size and athleticism that he has over Marcus Smart. But yeah, I mean, Dante Exum's kind of a blank slate in terms of evidence.
And I know he's a wild card, and you know, there are probably people that have watched him a lot more than I have. But, you know, I have watched a good, decent bit of tape, and it's, you know, most of it's against an Australian league that's not going to even approach NCAA levels a lot of the time. But first of all, he's projected to be borderline unplayable defensively right away. Yeah, at least that's what I've seen. Am I incorrect about that?
No, I mean, I think he's just got the size and quickness that he can be good. You know, I don't know that he'll have the smarts defensively.
Perhaps I'm incorrect, but I thought I had seen that the general discussion on him from people who had watched him a lot is that he really struggles in terms of staying in front of people and in terms of defensive awareness and things like that. Don't quote me, because maybe there's a small chance I'm wrong there. But and you know, I want, you know, he's very dynamic athletically. He's a good finisher and things like that. But Smart has a lot of those same things as well. And I would think at least that Smart projects better defensively. It was just a kind of a thought, you know.
I think Smart might be the second best defensive player in this draft behind Joel Embiid. Mm-hmm. And as a side note, Dean has on his big board on his site, DeanOnDraft.com, Joel Embiid number one, Dante Exum number two, and Marcus Smart number three.
Yeah, it's really interesting board. Just real quick, Julius Randle is down in like the 30s somewhere.
Yeah,
or 22, which is, I was going to ask him about, but we didn't have time.
Yeah, we got to have him on again. But we do right now have Dan Clayton coming in, calling in from New York City. Dan, are you there?
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Good. I'm glad to have you back on the show. It doesn't feel like a Salt City Hoops show without you.
Well, it's good to be back.
I'm glad. So I want to have you on the show for a bunch of reasons. Number one, we had this great Twitter argument yesterday. I had asked you to come on the show before then, and so I don't want to spend too much time on it, but you, Ben, and I had a feisty conversation last night on Twitter regarding LeBron, and as I woke up today, I realized I have no idea what we were fighting about. Like, just none.
And I'm not feisty. I'm never feisty. That's a lie.
Like, I don't know what I believe. I don't know what Dan believes. I don't know what Ben thinks. So, Dan, what was your point regarding this whole LeBron thing last night before we go into some draft and jazz stuff?
Well, here's what got me feisty and what was, you know, at the center of it all, my main point. And, you know, you try to convey that 140 characters at a time, and obviously people grab different parts of your argument and turn that into something different, and that's probably where we wound up on a bunch of tangents. My point at the core is that San Antonio did not win that game because the gym was hot. Okay, they played a really good game. They shot 59%. They had 30 assists. They won the rebounding total by double digits. They won the points in the paint battle by double digits. They played really well. And it was the exact same temperature where they were playing as it was where everyone else was playing. At the same time, I mean, it's obvious that over the course of the last 4 minutes, the absence of LeBron James had an impact, and it would be crazy to say otherwise. What I'm not sure I can grant is that the Heat had some, and I'm Heat with a lowercase H, by the way, is that the Heat had some you know, profound separate impact on LeBron because of the type of player he is. We know that he's had cramping problems in the past, and I, by the way, find it ridiculous. I was being accused of being one of the people, you know, making the might all jokes or saying that LeBron was sandbagging or that he should play through it, and that's not at all what I was saying. You know, I've dealt with severe cramps myself, and while every cramping situation is different, just like every sprained ankle is different, you know, it's pretty clear to me that what was happening to LeBron was serious, but the fact that he was, you know, the only guy out of 20 or so that saw on-court action that had that experience, I think it has more to do with the fact that, you know, he has a cramping problem. He's cramped up before in arenas that weren't 88 degrees, and the Heat certainly exacerbated the dehydration, but long before any of that happened, the Spurs were playing just a really excellent game. They scored 110 points, for Pete's sake. What was bothering me was the narrative that the asterisk talk, right? That the Spurs won because of a faulty AC unit.
Yeah, and Dan, in terms of from my perspective, I think we actually disagreed a lot less than it perhaps seemed. And it should be noted that directly after that game, my fandom was still slightly in effect in terms of LeBron. The only area I think where I even in any way disagree with any of what you just said, Dan, is that I do think that there's, based on the style of play, the major amount of mass that he's carrying in his body, and more importantly, the frequency with which he moves, I think there's no player moving more on the court than him, maybe Tony Parker, I suppose, in a game like that. I do think a player like LeBron, and again, I'm not a doctor, and this is not backed up by specific medical research, and I know that we got into that a bit on Twitter last night as well, but I do think someone like LeBron is potentially affected more by those types of circumstances. Yes, he has had these issues in the past, and I don't necessarily think that that's unrelated to the fact that the man is clearly pushing his body in ways that other, or to levels maybe that other guys aren't necessarily getting to, even within the NBA. And you know, I completely agree with everything else. It's ridiculous to say that the Heat would have definitely won, or that things would have definitely gone completely differently. There was a lot of time in the game that LeBron missed that he normally would play in, and saying what would have happened during those periods is very difficult. And like you said, the Spurs were playing incredible. I think there's a very good chance that with a fully healthy LeBron in there, the Spurs still win that game. So yeah, saying that, and you know, and then on the other side of the coin, of course, LeBron's no quitter, and the fact that that's even a publicly discussed topic still is kind of awesome.
Just backing up your point really quick, Dan, before you respond, looked up the SportView data from last night. LeBron was indeed the second most traveled player on the court last night with 2.3 miles. First place was Tony Parker, number one, 2.8.
Just, yeah, no, I mean, being stat boy for, look, a second. He has a role that he's expected to, be the key player on every offensive and defensive possession for that team. So honestly, I think, you know, that should be the conversation we're having today, is how Miami has, evolved into such a LeBron-dependent team. And you saw that in the last 4 minutes. In fact, Spoelstra's post-game interview was interesting because he talked a lot about how his guys just sort of appeared to give up once LeBron went out, right? San Antonio had played a really good game up to that point and deserves all the credit for that. But when LeBron sat down, you know, they stopped rotating defensively, they stopped executing their stuff. And to me, that's the bigger issue is, and I don't think it has to do with LeBron cramping or with the Heat. I think it happens all the time when Miami comes down the stretch in close games. Sometimes they forget who they are, especially offensively. The time it occurred to me most recently was Game 5 against Indiana. You know, what makes them so potent offensively is all the ball movement, and that they're a threat. They have this spread offense that keeps everybody honest. And then all of a sudden they come down the stretch in Game 5 and it's close. And for like 7 or 8 straight possessions in that fourth quarter, they went to a two-man game on the left side of the floor with Mario Chalmers and Chris Bosh. And I'm like, why? You know, why would a team that won 54 games, the second seed in the East, and has gotten this far, why would a team just like throw out their playbook and be like, I don't know, let's just try UT? So I think that's more my issue is Miami just needs to remember who they are and not be a team that's. I think that if LeBron wasn't such their offensive crack pipe, they've got a couple of probable Hall of Famers on that roster behind LeBron. They probably should not have collapsed to the tune of 30-6 in the end there. But again, you know, my point isn't about LeBron. It sucks for LeBron that he went through that. It sucks for the rest of us, because I'm like you, Ben. I'm in awe of what LeBron can do, and we as basketball fans would have had a much better entertainment experience and a much better show if LeBron had been able to finish that game. So it sucks. I wasn't celebrating at all. I'm certainly not criticizing LeBron for not being able to finish the game. I do think that he has a problem that at some point he and the physical trainers there need to figure out how to address, because for this to happen at a moment like that is pretty unfortunate.
I love LeBron as offensive Miami Heat crackpipe.
Yeah,
that was the best.
That's solid.
Thing you said.
Yeah, that's the soundbite for this show.
In fact, that's what we're calling this podcast.
I want to ask you, because, you know, the reason we did have you on the show originally is because you were at the draft lottery in New York City, and I kind of just wanted to get your impressions of the event. I want to know the crazy anecdotes. I want to know if, like, Randy Rigby screamed in disappointment. I want to know, you know, what happens, what's that draft lottery room like, first of all?
Yeah, well, it's funny. They keep the media in this green room next door while they're on air. Not next door. I mean, it's, you know, literally one room over. So I wasn't in the room reading Randy Raby's face when that happened. Although we were let in as soon as they weren't live anymore. It was interesting. But, you know, one thing I'll say is Dennis Lindsay is a stud, and I appreciate the fact that he would give me the amount of time and attention he gave me. You know, he had people waiting on him in Salt Lake City, yourself included, Andy.
Yeah.
and yet still, you know, took the time in a very thorough way to address my questions, which I think are, you know, somewhat representative of the questions of Jazz Nation.
Were you the only Jazz media member there?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So I also talked to the four Jazz guys in the room a little bit, you know, not officially. So, I'm not going to represent everything they said to me while the recorders weren't rolling. But I talked to Randy Rigby, Brian Miller, Dennis Lindsay, and, of course, Jonathan Reinhart was there from a PR standpoint. Talked to all of them. I will tell you that the guy who probably was hiding his disappointment the least of the four was Randy. He looked like someone had just stolen his kitten or something. although, you know, when I asked him the question, you know, he gave the line about, you know, deep draft, plenty of talent and that kind of stuff. But
his face showed the kitten.
What's that?
His face showed the stolen kitten.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Did you guys see? I don't even know how much he was really on the TV program.
He was on it, but they were beyond when the actual Jazz selection was announced. They didn't spend a whole lot of time with that.
Yeah.
They were looking more at the Cavs. The Cavs were obviously the big story once the right. final order was revealed.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, once the Cavs were not in their position, was it eight? I think they were slotted eight.
Or it might have even been ninth or tenth.
It was ninth. Yeah.
Yeah. Once they skipped over the Cavs' name, and you knew that by virtue of that the Cavs had jumped into the top three, all of a sudden you're doing the math, and mm-hmm. the writing was pretty much on the wall at that point.
Once it got to the fifth, we were either fifth or we were in the top three. There was no chance of fourth at that point.
Exactly. So the chances of, you know, both the Cavs and the Jazz vaulting everybody else pretty low. So, I think that it was pretty amazing. I will say, too, that in the room I was in with all the media, and it's, you know, a pretty significant-sized group of media, at least a hundred or two folks covering the event for different outlets, there was a pretty big groan when Cleveland won. I mean, nobody could believe that Cleveland won.
It's unbelievable.
There were also some funny moments, the same funny moments that people reacted to about the live telecast, got a big rise out of people like Dr. J glancing around the room angrily when they read the pick that New Orleans owed them, that wound up being conveyed because of the protections, because New Orleans wound up outside of the top six, when they read, you know, the whatever pick it was, this pick now belongs to the Philadelphia 76ers, he looked around like all mad, like, no, there's no way. We can only be 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So that was kind of humorous. And the other good anecdote I'll share from that night is, so I'm talking to Brian Miller, and as I'm wrapping up the conversation, a couple guys come in, and they're clearly sort of waiting to talk to him next. And so I finish up, and I thank him for his time, and as I'm, you know, trying to navigate where I'm going next, these two guys start talking to him, and apparently they were Brooklyn media dudes, and they said to him, and obviously they were joking, and they're media guys, so it doesn't mean anything anyway, but they turned to him and they said, hey, you know, you're a Utah Jazz guy. We were just wondering if you want Darren Williams back, because you can just take him. So definitely I got the sense from our colleagues across the river in Brooklyn that they've got some pretty complicated feelings still about their all-star point guard.
Yeah, I know that that's been a sore spot just following Brooklyn Net fan Twitter. It's, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I live in Brooklyn, so, you know, I get that a lot from people that, you know, especially when they make the connection that I'm a Jazz guy. They'll say, oh, you guys gave us Andre Kirilenko and Deron Williams. You know, thanks for Andre.
Yeah.
So, fun.
All right. Well, Dan, thanks again for joining us. Well, you'll also be representing us at the draft itself. So we'll look for more coverage from you then, and we'll talk to you then.
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks, Dan. I love that story. Just first of all, good. Dan's metaphors are great. The stolen kitten, the crack pipe of the Heat offense, and then just I love that he's the only Utah media guy there, just kind of pestering Dennis Lindsay, yeah, and Brian Miller with questions. I mean, I had the chance to talk to them via Skype from the media room and here at Energy Solutions Arena. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, it's a different feel when you have these guys in person.
Like a Skype scrum? Is that what it pretty much
was? It was, yeah.
That's cool.
And, you know, all gathered around the computer. But, yeah, so it's a different feeling when you see these guys in person and have Randy Rigby looking like a sad puppy who stole, you know, the sad puppy and kitten thing doesn't work as well. I should leave the metaphors for Dan. But now we're near the end of the show, which means it's time for our final segment, the crazy trade idea of the week.
Oh, yeah.
You forgot?
I didn't make one yet.
Okay, that's
Hold
okay.
On.
I have one.
I was hoping
I have
you
one.
Have one. Okay.
This is why we're prepared podcast hosts, is because we have one trade of the week. And I love this. This is from the Real GM message board, so you know it's real. It's really good. It is Trey Burke for number 4. And let me pull it up. I apologize. It is Trey Burke, number 5. We need the Jeopardy noise.
My whistling doesn't work. I'm not a good enough whistler this early in the morning.
You know, when you're trying to navigate the Real GM message boards, here we go. Okay, number 12 and number 4 from the Orlando Magic. They own both picks for Trey Burke and the number 5. That wasn't complicated. I could have come up with that.
I like that.
So you move up one pick, give up Trey Burke for the number 12. You know, Trey Burke taking number 9 that last year. You can take whoever you want at number 12 and whoever you want at number 4.
I'm not so sure Orlando would do that deal, but especially because you would think they'd be probably cool with either Smart or Exum, right? If they're assuming the other 3 go off before them. Or, you know, you never know how they internally value those sort of guys. But I would like that probably from the Jazz's perspective. We heard you heard me earlier talking about Elfrid Payton, and he's a guy who could potentially be available in that 12 range, although you never know if he'd be where the Jazz would look if they did end up looking at either Smart or Exum with that 4th pick that they moved up into.
The only reason I think the Magic will take it is because Magic fan Devin1L from the Real GM message board, so, you know, who's basically their general manager in terms of importance.
Oh, yeah.
Says, as a Magic fan, comma, I like it. So we have support.
Yeah, that's all I need to hear.
But I like it too. I mean, yeah, it moves the Jazz up into that top 4 where you can get a franchise-level player. You know, Trey Burke is a good but not great prospect, but he gives Orlando the point guard that they've been looking for. You know, you have some assurance that he will be able to contribute on an NBA level. You know, at the very least, he's not. He's probably a starter-level NBA point guard right now. You know, who has the potential to improve. And, you know, so I would say number 12 for Trey Burke is fair in a vacuum, maybe a little bit too tilted towards Magic, so you flip it a little bit by giving just swapping the number 4 and number 5.
Yeah, and by the way, I should mention, I think I was a tad remiss before in saying that Exum projects to be a liability defensively. That was a little off. I don't think he projects that badly. He does need to improve his physical strength quite a bit in that area, but he is quick, as we know, and he's very long. So, just so I don't get slammed on that one later.
So, if you have number 4 and number 12, do you take Exum number 4, presuming the top 3 guys are off the board?
Yeah, I guess I probably do, and I'm trusting in some sense they're the people who have seen him a lot more than people like us, and
right,
and that the you know, the physical skill set offensively really is, you know, generational and very unique and, you know, sort of Magic Johnson-esque, though I don't love those comparisons, but in, you know, a few parts of his offensive game, I guess I would probably be taking him, although I won't lie, I would not be feeling super confident about it.
Okay, and then number 12, you still take Elfrid Payton, even though you just took Dante Exum, even though Payton's your guy.
That's where that gets a little tough, I suppose. And it depends on who else you potentially like that's in that area. Somebody who might be this could potentially be a little bit of a reach considering where he's projected, but I do like KJ McDaniels a lot.
Yeah.
You might be moving up a bit for him there, but it's not, that wouldn't necessarily be bad. You could look at a guy like him. You could, if you like Mitch McGarry, you could maybe look at him, although I don't, again, that'd be a big reach too. Based on where they're projected currently. And those are a couple guys. I mean, could move up for Kristaps Porzingis, depending on how much you like him. I mean, or one of the other
foreign players,
Nurkic or Saric that's in the draft.
Yeah, Saric might be available at number 12. I'd also look at Kyle Anderson there. I know he's been low on the draft board recently, but, I mean, I love Kyle Anderson's game. I think he makes it in the NBA somehow, whether that's as a stretch four or as a crazy tall point guard. He's just got the skill set to be able to contribute in some way. But I think that gives the Jazz a lot. You know, you lose Trey Burke, the man who we all love so much, but I think you gain a lot for the Jazz moving forward in the future. So that could be kind of exciting. Anyway, now that we've done our crazy trade idea of the week, as well as talked about our crazy LeBron moment last night and the draft, I want to thank Dean DeMacus again for joining us, as well as Dan Clayton from New York City. This is Andy Larson from the Salt City Hoops podcast signing off.